I just kind of watched the fire.
There it is. Very good.
Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order this morning. Committee, we've got a short agenda today, and we will not be working House Bill 2765 today. We will not have a work session on House Bill 2765 today. So with that, and which one was Barbara Smith Warner here on?
This one.
I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2684.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this bill makes permanent provisions allowing retired members of PERS to be employed full-time by public employer as a nursing instructor or as a trainer for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training without a loss of retirement benefits. There are no amendments.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. Thank you for having me here. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, and I am a House Representative for District 45, which is Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. I am here on behalf of House Bill 2684, which in the summary is really just about all of what it is. This bill was brought to me by a constituent, Christina Cowgill, who I believe you'll hear from this morning as well, dealing with an issue we all hear a lot about, the shortage of healthcare providers. And if you go back up the food chain from that, there's also a shortage of instructors to help train those the needed providers that we have, particularly in nursing, when working as a nurse is much more, you'll make a lot more working as a nurse than you do as a nursing instructor. So this is one of those opportunities to make it so that someone who has been a nurse in the public system can go back, become it, and be a nursing instructor or continue to be a nursing instructor and not be penalized through their PERS. We need to recruit these experienced, qualified instructors, and I think this is a common sense, reasonable way to do that. So I hope that you will agree and support this bill.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Questions for Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, could you maybe give us some background on why they were dropped out in the first place? There must have been a reason, or some, even though it may have been foggy or what.
Oh, I believe it was a Chair Holvey, Representative Esquivel. I believe it was a sunset, and so we're trying to recover. But let me confirm that.
Okay, gotcha.
Thank you. Other questions? Not seeing anything this morning. Thank you for getting us started on this bill this morning, and hope you have a great day.
Thank you.
Up next,
for the sunset.
Eric's
Gablix.
And maybe we can bring up Jana Britton as well. Is that all right? I'll call you up in the next panel then. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Eric Skablix. I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, often known as DPSST. To give you a little bit of background, DPSST operates the Oregon Public Safety Academy here in Salem on 235 acres, and we have over 500 employees, most of which are part-time instructors at our campus, but we have about 100 full-time staff. Our mission through legislative action is to train and certify over 41,000 public safety providers in the state of Oregon. That includes city, county, tribal police officers, corrections officers, career volunteer firefighters, and the list goes on and on. When this bill came up previously, the same issues that the nursing community for education were facing, DPSST was facing, and that is, how do we get seasoned law enforcement officers that have lots of knowledge, lots of experience, lots of training to give back, if you will, after they retire and be trainers. DPSST had the same challenges the nursing community did. We are able to recruit small and mid-sized agency people to come work with us, but we have limited overtime, actually no overtime budget, and we have limited promotional opportunities. So we were missing an element of people that had great experience in larger agencies but would not leave those positions to come to us. Through this ability in the legislature to retire and come to work for DPSST full-time. We do have six full-time staff that are retired PERS members that are training our public safety providers, and it's been very successful. We're aware of our relationship with Oregon AFSCME. It's a good one, but they don't want to see everybody at DPSST retired, nor do we. But there is a need for these individuals. We do have, as I mentioned, six right now, and they are open and competitive. So when we have a recruitment come open, it's open competitive. So we're really looking for the best candidate, not a PERS retiree, who's best to fit the bill. So I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have, but I wanted to give you a background on why we're here.
Questions? So you're not getting off that easy. I have a question. is the issue that these instructors are just not paid enough to, I mean, it seems like when you retire from PERS, you should be retired, and then people are coming back still being retired. Why don't they just stay as an employee and do the instruction?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, it's a very good question, and that's the discussion we've had with our bargaining unit. We understand that they look at it as, look, these people have had a great career. They should retire and let a new person come on board. The challenge that we have is with the compensation level. We're not competitive in the metro area with the larger agencies. So we are competitive with smaller communities of less than 20 officers, but we're not going to get a person from the metro area or a larger organization to come with us. We are way below the mark on that compensation.
So it is a compensation issue as far as people would rather retire and come back as an instructor instead of staying in and just becoming an instructor and staying an employee.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, the challenge that we have is we work a straight 40-hour work week with very limited overtime. If I'm a officer or firefighter at a mid-size or larger fire department or law enforcement agency, there's incentive pay if I'm involved in special operations. If I'm a paramedic, I may get 7% incentive pay. If I'm on hazmat, I get 7% incentive pay. We don't have any of that at DPSST, and those folks truly have training and experience that we want to share with new people coming into the profession. So the PERS retirement ability that we have allows us to recruit those people to come to us, but we're very careful that we're not just a place for a PERS retiree to come. We want people with passion to train and passion to basically provide their knowledge, skills, and ability to the people coming into the field today.
Okay, well, we'll move on. Thank you. Up next, Jana Britton, Christy Cowgill, and Jack Dempsey. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Could you introduce yourself for the record?
Good morning, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Christina Cowgill, and as introduced by Representative Barbara Smith-Warner, I am one of her constituents and brought this bill forward on behalf of the Oregon Nursing Leadership Collaborative, the ONLC, which I'm currently a chair of. This collaborative convenes five members of both practice background and faculty background in nursing. I wanted to offer the committee a little bit of background of why we brought this forward. So in 2007, the Oregon legislature passed Senate Bill 4, and that bill addressed three key topics. Number one, it declared that there was a nursing workforce and nursing faculty shortage. It allowed nurses and nursing educators who work on a less than half-time basis to be eligible for health insurance through the Public Employees Benefit Board. And number three, it also allowed retired nurses to work in areas where public employers as nursing instructors without jeopardizing their status in the PERS. Those amendments in 2007, as a result of Senate Bill 4, have been a huge retention tool for experienced nurses and faculty who work for the state. And this also includes those nurses who work at OHSU's hospitals and clinics and at the state hospital, and also at the OHSU six off-site faculty, OHSU's off-site campuses for nursing education. So the shortage that was declared in 2007 is still in effect today. In fact, the latest HRSA projections in 2004 state that Oregon will have a shortage of between 6,000 and 7,000 registered nurses. And this is very consistent with the projections made by the Oregon Center for Nursing, which you'll hear from next. So currently, the amendments that were in effect from 2007, Senate Bill 4, are scheduled to expire January 2nd of 2016. House Bill 2684 that's before you would remove this sunset and allow nurses and nurse faculty who work for public entities to continue to work, alleviating these workforce shortages and keeping experienced nurses in the workforce. I appreciate your support. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Holby and the members of the committee. My name is Jana Bitten, and I am the Executive Director for the Oregon Center for Nursing, and I am here to provide testimony on behalf of House Bill 2684. To give you a little bit of background, the Oregon Center for Nursing is a nonprofit organization that was formed in 2002 with the purpose of ensuring that Oregonians have the most well-prepared and superior nursing workforce to be able to serve the healthcare needs of our communities. Our work centers on identifying critical issues that are related to nursing workforce to ensure that we have enough nurses and that the nurses that we have are well-qualified and well-prepared. The work that we do is proactive, and it helps our leaders make corrective actions early so that we can ensure that these issues are taken care of as soon as possible. A part of our core work is to do research and collect data on the nursing workforce. And we have been studying the nurse faculty workforce for quite some time. In fact, the Oregon Center for Nursing was part of Senate Bill 4, and we were the ones that brought forward this exemption for the PERS for nurses back in 2007. And we support the ONLC in bringing it forward today. The story about the nursing workforce right now really focuses on nurse faculty, and OCN has done a very recent survey in 2014. We're going to be releasing a report on that in the next couple of months, but I wanted to share today some of the preliminary findings that we had of that so that you can see how that relates to this House bill and how it removing the sunset would be good for the nursing workforce. Nurse faculty in Oregon are aging, and just like all Oregonians, they're reaching retirement age. 54% of the nurse faculty are over the age of 55, and 12% are over the age of 65. Many of these nurse faculty intend to retire or have already retired. 31% of nurse faculty with a master's degree and 28% of nurses with a doctorate plan to retire in the next 5 years. That means that we're going to need about 117 new nurse faculty. Our projections are 117 over the next 10 years. Finding nurse faculty is extremely difficult, mostly because it takes a long time to be able to educate somebody to have a master's degree or a doctorate to be able to teach at that level. In fact, we have a story from a nurse faculty on the coast who said that they run into a lot of problems when they're trying to recruit for a nurse faculty because their human resources department at their community college will put out a notice saying that they need a nurse faculty, and they expect it to be similar to the faculty positions that they have for, say, an English teacher. An English teacher, they might get 100 different applications for someone to be an English teacher, and yet for a nurse faculty, they may get 3. It's very difficult to find nurse faculty. Many nurses and nurse faculty are actually choosing to delay their retirement. And this is a national trend that's been going on well before the recession that took place. In Oregon, it's exactly the same. Back in 2008, when we did our study, 57% of nurses said they anticipated retiring by age 65. This new number says that that's now 80%. So now 80% of nurses say that they plan to work past a retirement age. The study that we're going to be doing and we're trying to find out is why. It could be the reason why they're choosing to stay on is because they aren't seeing the people to come and replace them. And that is part of the reason why we actually need them to delay their retirement. We need these nurses to stay on board because we need the time to be able to educate the next level, the next generation of nurse leaders, to continue educating our nurses and keeping our nurse workforce strong. Thank you for this opportunity, and I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Jack Dempsey representing the Oregon Nurses Association. We support House Bill 2684. I'll be pretty break this down pretty simple. So this is set to sunset at the end of this year. Anecdotally, I've heard it's about 40 instructors up at OHSU. I think you can safely assume maybe another 40 at our community colleges. Whether you agree with the policy or not, if that goes into effect, we're not going to be able to replace that, and our programs are going to suffer in the short run. And then you couple in with the boomers and the other folks that are there that are ready to retire, it just makes the problem worse. So we see this as something that we have to do to protect us. So happy to answer questions.
Questions. Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I believe you and I were on the business and labor, and we've heard this when it was passed. But are we gaining anything on this? We've gone now 6-8 years. Are we gaining any ground on it? Because it was the same argument in 2007.
I think it's safe to say, Chair Holvey and Representative Esquivel, that I'm not sure we're gaining on this, but we're going to prevent anything worse.
Sure, I understand that part, but I mean, I just wonder how can we figure out a way where we can gain on this instead of continually doing this.
And Chair Holvey and Representative Esquivel, I think that is part of the work that we have been doing, and from my perspective, it feels like there's been a lot of experimentation. There are a lot of states that are trying to find ways to be able to help with faculty, but the argument still stands that always has stood is that the average salary of a nurse in practice doesn't come close to the average salary of a nurse faculty. And so trying to encourage and incentivize people to go into nurse faculty, it's a hard sell. We're trying to come up with different solutions and programs that might encourage nurses to choose the faculty route and trying to be as creative as we possibly can. And that's a national effort. There's a lot of this is not just an Oregon problem. There's a lot of people that are working on this now. And are we gaining any ground? Yes, but it's slow going. And I think that removing the sunset and being able to keep these nurses and this nurse faculty in their positions is going to be what we need. Like Mr. Dempsey said, just to keep things from getting worse.
And just to clarify, so you're saying that nurse faculty really don't make as much money as a full-fledged nurse.
True.
In regular practice, and that's what causes the problem.
True. And I wish that I could tell you exactly what the average salary of a nurse faculty is. I think it's hard because it's different if you're an adjunct or if you're an associate professor. And I think that, you know, in some ways when you're talking about university level versus community college, you're comparing apples to oranges.
Yeah.
So I don't really know. I know that the average salary of a nurse in Oregon is $81,000 a year. And I do know that it's not close for faculty.
Yeah, I will say that I sit on the State Workforce Investment Board, and this subject has come up with the healthcare industry and nursing being probably the biggest shortage of workforce that we're going to be facing. And it'd be interesting to have do some outreach with the State Workforce Investment Board on this specific problem about nursing faculty. I think it would be good for them to hear this problem.
Yes.
As they're trying to figure out how to address workforce needs across the state.
Yes.
So I thank you for that clarification. Are there any other questions? Representative Benetto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Barreto.
Barreto.
Jeez. Give me at least till April, would you?
Thank you. Just a couple questions. One, the $81,000 a year, is that to include benefits or is that excluding benefits?
I believe that is excluding benefits.
Okay. And then one of the other, I think Christina, you were saying a shortage of 6,000 to 7,000 nurses. When was that projected? And that was in Oregon, is that correct?
Yeah, that was the 2014 HRSA results. And that actually is very similar to what we're finding with OCN's research as well at the state level.
Follow up. Is that because nurses are being required to do more things? I mean, there's more of a need for nurses with the change in healthcare? or is this just a shortage from lack of people going into that profession?
Yeah, Chair Holvey and Representative Barreto. I think that it is not necessarily because of a lack of people going into that profession. I think it has a lot more to do with the population of Oregon is aging, and that requires more health care. And I think it also has to do with nurses taking on new and emerging roles, which is another topic that we are studying, because that's something that we haven't even begun to really completely understand with the transformation of health care.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Nose.
It's not a question, it's more of a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just say part of the problem around this is that it's not easy to get a master's. Most of the nurses who maybe want to become master's prepared so that they can be an instructor are also working at the same time, right? So they're trying to do that. It's expensive to get a master's, and if you stop out, you suffer a shock in income to acquire that degree, and then you go back into the workforce to teach, and it's not as financially lucrative as it is being a nurse or even a nurse manager in a hospital unit. So that's just part of the problem. I think there's a lot of nurses that would like to do something different with their career, but it's not easy to do.
Thank you. Representative Doherty.
Yeah, from what I understand, part of the nurse shortage is because you cannot get instructors, that you might have a lot of students applying for nursing school, but you can't admit them because of lack of faculty. Is that still an issue? I know it was a couple of years ago.
And Chair Holvey, Representative Doherty, yes, that does have a lot to do with it. It's in the nursing world, we call that part of the pipeline of getting someone educated so that they can actually join the nursing workforce. And yes, that has a lot to do with it. Part of what we are, the Oregon Center for Nursing is doing, is trying to take a look at what are the is how bad is that? How bad is that particular problem where people can, qualified applicants are applying to nursing school, but they can't get in because there just isn't the capacity to be able to teach them? And if I could also add, I texted my associate and just asked her if she knew what the average salary was for a nurse faculty. She says, we don't have recent data. In 2009, it was $57,000 a year.
Thank you. Representative
Evans.
Evans. Well.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Okay. Just in terms of, just for clarification on numbers, I can tell you for a fact a tenure track professor position at Chemeketa Community College last year was $42,000 a year. So just putting the numbers in the hopper.
Trying to decide who goes next here. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was explained to us the last time, and I think it still holds true. It's like an hourglass. The demand and people that want to learn are up here. The teaching ability is here, and the demand for people to work in the workforce is down here, so it looks like a great big hourglass. I think that pretty much sums it up then, and it sums it up now.
Very good. I think we've exhausted our questions finally for you. Thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. We'll look forward to doing some more work on it later.
Yes, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you. That'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2684. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2618. Jan, could you describe the bill in front of us now?
Mr. Chair, committee members, this measure classifies as a police officer under PERS any employees of the Department of Human Services whose duties include maintaining the safety, behavior, and control of the residents of certain residential facilities, declares an emergency effective on passage, and there are no amendments before you.
Thank you. We have Ralph Groner, Don Loving, and Randy Ritterbush.
Thank you very much, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner, representing Ask Me Council 75. I'm here really as a mediator with experts. This problem we're having with SACU stands for Stabilization and Crisis Units. Actually, we began meeting with legislators. These homes are only in the Willamette Valley. We started in Eugene. Representative Holvey was there. We then went to Portland and invited every legislator to our meeting. We had so many, I can't recall who was there. And then we did Salem, the governor's staff, as well as legislative leadership and Salem area leaders. So we've worked hard on this. Why we're working hard is, just to say it quickly, in 91 we had our first state off group home. Fairview hasn't totally closed yet. We're talking about ex-Fairview clients, which at one time was thousands of clients here in Salem. Our people were handling not only the milder cases, but guarding murders and rapists at Fairview. Many people didn't realize that. So what happened is why we're here. The state op group homes, I was assigned this local 1246 when this occurred, in 1990, by the director of our agency. I then attended with our first staff rep the meetings that created the state op, so I have some knowledge of what the intent was in Oregon. Those state ops were to take about a small percent of the clients of Fairview, and the vast majority, as high as 98%, were to go to the private sector, IDD, intellectual developmentally disabled. We also represent a number of those. But the fact is, we were giving the worst clients up in the state of Oregon. And what happened is, we were fine with that. We had the medically fragile, by the way, I'm told now most of them had died. And we had the worst clients. If the private sector had someone so bad they couldn't handle them, they came to state op group homes. Over time, the state went to community-based corrections. And our name was changed from state-operated group homes, and this is why we're here, to stabilization and crisis. I want to underline that word, crisis units, because we, of all agencies, are frankly in the worst crisis in the state of Oregon. We are. And the fact is, you'll hear from Randy Ritterbush, our expert rep, and you'll hear from our PERS expert, Don Loving, in our union. I only want to say that it's gotten so bad, and we want to thank Rep. Holvey. We are piecemealing fixing the problem. In Eugene, Rep. Holvey held his hand up and said, I'll work your workers' comp crisis. We had a big one. Rep. Holvey brought it back to the last session, February, and fixed our workers' comp issue. Then our next issue was, my God, we have people that have been with Fairview and are now 60 and older getting half killed. They shouldn't have been in this position. They should have been on PERS, police and fire, long ago, because if you were to look at our corrections officers, they say to me, Ralph, I wouldn't work there. You look at my state hospital, which has also asked me, they say, Ralph, I wouldn't work there. And you go down to the hall to my friends that are troopers that are responding, they say, we're the ones who respond, we wouldn't work there. And by the way, in Portland, the police aren't responding to our crisis since they're so common. Where we're at, we're getting hurt badly. Not only that, clients, and if you haven't read lately, the neighbors are getting hurt. Mm-hmm. From Newburgh, all over, Lebanon, in Oregon. We have a terrible crisis, and I mean that wholeheartedly. So we're here today to try to help our people who are defined as guards in the law, who are in a very dangerous job with the people coming to ask me now, to our sent to us now, who are very, very dangerous. So I want to turn it over now, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, to Don Loving, who is our communications director for about 30 years, but he's also our PERS expert. Don?
There's no such thing as a PERS expert. Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Don Loving. By and large, I'm the communications director for AFSCME. I do meddle down here in this building occasionally. PERS is one of the things that I meddle in. I think I'd like to start by noting that the police and fire tier is one of the few things related to PERS that we can't hang on my longtime, now quasi, former colleague Mary Botkin. Police and fire actually predates Mary, which means it's been around for a long time. But Mary does have the best definition of why we have a police and fire tier. And I'm going to sort of paraphrase her here. It is to acknowledge the risks involved in the inability of public employees performing certain jobs to complete a normal retirement period of 30 years and or to recognize that certain employees will statistically die sooner as a result of performing those jobs. Generally we're talking about, public safety related type things. There in the PERS statute, there is, list of these professions qualify for police and fire tier PERS. Not surprisingly, the first two listed are police officers and firefighters. And there are now about another 17 that have been added over the years to that. Importantly, one of those that came about with little argument was corrections officers, or as they were referred to at the time, prison guards. They don't like that term. Don't call them that. But, nobody argued that a corrections officer should be in police and fire tier. And interestingly enough, in 1994, the Oregon Court of Appeals ruled that the folks who work in the behavioral group homes for the state of Oregon, the folks we're talking about right here, were properly defined as guards at a mental hospital. They went on to describe the definition of guard, and it's the same language, the same nuances, according to our legal counsel, that were used to put the corrections officers, prison guards, in there in the first place. So these folks have that same legal definition that the corrections officers have. So with that in mind, sort of a serendipity for us, because as most of you are aware, we represent almost all of the corrections employees in the state of Oregon as well, so we're very familiar with them. So I requested some numbers for staff assaults from the prisons, which we didn't get from DOC before today, and also from DHS for the SACU unit. We actually heard from DHS twice. They sent us two sets of numbers. They corrected the first set by saying that they had inadvertently, for the current year, included what they call near misses in the numbers, and that those shouldn't have been included. Randy's going to talk about the numbers in a bit more detail here, but I guess I would just like to say that if you're working at somewhere that tracks near misses as well as hits, that's fairly indicative of a dangerous workplace, and I would say that would put you at risk. My broader point is that even using the damped down numbers from DHS for the hits and near misses, the assault rate on our SACU staff is way, way higher than it is on correction staff. Certainly a prison is a dangerous place to work, and you can't let your guard down, so to speak, at any given point in time. But the reality is, according to my folks, who represent our corrections employees, is that maybe two or three times in a month is there, an actual physical assault, someone getting hit, somebody getting kicked, somebody getting bit in a state prison. And most of those are sort of collateral damage when they break up a fight between inmates. It's very infrequent that an inmate actually plans an attack on a corrections officer. Our folks that work in SACU are constant victims of attacks. The numbers, show that a rate 5 to 7 times higher than what happens in the prisons. They are injured all the time. And that, again, that doesn't include the near misses. I'd like to close with one other thought here. We closed Damish State Hospital in 1995, we closed Fairview in 2000. The Oregon State Hospital, even when the Junction City campus is open and fully running, will still be, house less people than OASH used to. There are literally some former clients of those institutions in the state prison system. There are many people who would have gone to those institutions if they could have handled them in the state prison system. We have prisons that have behavioral wings that are full of IDD folks. The corrections officers who work those wings are essentially doing the exact same job with people with the exact same diagnoses that our folks are doing in the state-operated group homes. There's very little difference. The difference is the officers can use physical restraints. They can be aggressive in dealing with the inmate. They can put them in solitary confinement. The SACU workers are instructed to be as docile as possible. They cannot use any sort of physical restraint. There's nothing akin to solitary confinement. They work in group home settings that essentially the model was built in the 1970s. And then we had adapted and adopted those starting in the 90s when we started to place people out of Fairview. But the clients originally from this model were back, you know, it was the folks that, you know, frankly, you know, we used to refer to as the mentally retarded, that were largely nonviolent, frequently nonverbal, and often immobile. And we've used that model moving forward to base the group homes to begin with. And the clients from Fairview that originally went are gone. And so we've turned over. We now have folks in the homes that are much stronger, much relatively smarter, much more prone to violence. And our folks are understaffed, overworked, and frequently assaulted. And given the legal status that they are the equivalent of corrections officers, we feel it's appropriate to have them long overdue moved in the police and fire tier first. Thank you.
Representative Holvey, Chair, and Vice Chair, and members of the committee, my name is Randy Ritterbush, and I've been the council representative at SACU for over a little over a year, so that does definitely not make me an expert on SACU and the folks that reside there. What I am an expert on is what my members go through day to day and the phone calls I receive. These folks work in an environment that is what it is. The clients, not through any fault of their own, they are mentally ill, make no mistake. They act out, and they have terrible behavior problems. And we know that we can't hold them responsible for it because they really don't know what they're doing in most cases. The clients have changed. They are much more manipulative. We have clients that hide cell phones inside their computers, break alarms so they can get out of the homes now, call and make contact with inmates in the prison so when they get out, they pick them up on the side of the road and have sex overnight and then report back to the home. This is the new client that the folks are dealing with. It's just the way it is. It's the jobs the state of Oregon pays these people to do. And as my colleague has mentioned, there are no tools that these folks can use to do their jobs. They're charged with control and custody of these folks inside the homes and outside the homes by themselves with no tools to do any of their jobs. And that's probably rightfully so. We're not complaining about that. That's just the way it is. But as a result of that, these folks are being beat up, their backs are being broken, they get bit. I was doing a stewards class the other day and there were four of my members from SACU there. And they were showing the class the bites on their arms, their broken noses, the scars on their backs, the pain pills they're taking to get through the day. There's nobody that works at SACU that believes they're not going to be seriously hurt in their career. It is a fact of life. The president's sitting here now, and his back has been damaged unrepairably, and he takes way too many drugs to get through the day, folks, way too many drugs. This is the typical life of somebody who works at SACU. By the time they get to the end of their career, they are crippled in most cases. You put 30 years into a place like this where you work 3 to 4 overtime shifts. Those are 16-hour shifts in a 40-hour period, 3 or 4 times a week. Not all the time, but it happens on a regular basis. This agency averages over 12,000 hours of overtime a month, distributed between less than 600 people. There's no way that we're not destroying their quality of life and their longevity when they retire. They go to work every day and kiss their kids and hope they come back looking the same. That's just the truth, and that's how my members have talked to me for a year. There is just no reason with an agency that's set to average 253 assaults this year on staff, we can say that they're not police and fire. I spent 10 years working inside of a prison. Never once was I scared. I represented them for another 5 years, and I still today walk around the prisons, and I have a state ID badge, a corrections ID badge, and talk to the members, not worried about it at all. I spent 5 years representing the nurses and doctors at the state hospital when we were building the new hospital. And it was a little strange walking around downstairs and put the hair on the back of my neck when I got locked into the cubes when there was an event on the floor. I'm scared when I'm in the group homes, just because I don't know what's going to happen. I just don't. You're at work one day and the client's just fine. You're taking them out to get a soda, which is really a big trip for these folks. And the person knocks you out, and you're laying on the ground while that person runs across the street and beats up a child and a mother in their own home. And these other folks have to run out, chase them, and deal with this issue. It is beyond me how we could not make these folks police and fire. And I thank you very much, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I don't think any of us, probably dispute the danger of the workplace that you work in. I don't, and the stories can be horrific. I've visited some of these places, and they are a little bit unnerving to walk into for sure. But just real quickly about the bill. I know the stories back up the reason for the bill. So what's the impact of that this bill has by, classifying these DHS workers as police officers in the PERS system? I mean, what's that do?
Well, Mr. Chair, Ralph Groner again, we're asking, and then we can have them answer. We're asking that you approve this bill and send it on to Ways and Means.
What's the bill do? Answer my question about
to 65.
Basically, what it does, it allows people to retire after 25 years instead of 30 years. Currently, there would be 65 members that would have that choice to retire out of the 560-some current employees at SACU. And actually, that's more than that because that includes managers. But the bill itself would, yes, it would cost a little bit of money, but it's not a windfall, huge windfall for members, because when you retire 5 years early, your PERS, it gets stretched out 5 years longer, so your benefit is a little bit less. So, yeah, it's a little bit of cost, but it's the only sane thing to do for these folks.
All right. Great. I think that I answered my key question. Anybody else saw us? Representative Esquivel.
Did I hear you correct when you said that they were giving 12,000 hours overtime?
There's an average in the last 13 months of 12,300, I think, hours a month of overtime in this agency.
I can't believe that's 71 people full-time for a month.
Yes, sir. It's over $4 million. It's over $4
million
cost of the state of Oregon.
Still,
in overtime,
who should be hiring people instead of paying overtime?
I'd like to add quickly, if he misses this, we're in front of Human Resource Sub tomorrow, and we have been arguing we need staff desperately. We've got people working 16 hours a day and getting the crap beat out of them because they're exhausted. So you've hit the hours, but we're in front of Ways and Means tomorrow, and that's part of
sense.
And clearly, when we go to Ways and Means, we're asking for more people. But the problem is at $13 an hour, who wants to do this job? And I'm now bargaining their contract, and I'll be working on that and trying to hope so. Because the truth is, the agency tells me, you can give me 100 more positions, but I can't hire them because nobody wants to do the work. That comes out of a very high-ranking individual within the agency. There's a lot of things to fix. As Ralph pointed out, we got to piecemeal this together. It's taken thousands of years of society to get us to the point where we're treating the mentally ill and the people that work with them at least this well. Nobody's criticizing us for that, but we have to continue to move forward. We have people that are not responsible for their own actions in a societal setting where without people being responsible for their own actions, it doesn't work. And we give people that are watching them no tools, and they're older, and they're being beat up, and they're crippled, and they can't chase people down the street. And by the way, if they get away, they lose their jobs because that's abuse. That's another story for another time, and I apologize for bringing that up.
Thank you. I appreciate
it. Mr. Chair, just 30 seconds, please. Just, I apologize. In a perfect world, I would have had time to have talked to our good friend Marjorie Taylor from PERS and gotten, you know, an estimate of the numbers on this. This bill had ways and means written all over it, so, you know, we'll get a number there. But, you know, to your question specifically, it would put these folks in the police and fire tier. They're allowed to retire a little earlier, and there's a small increase in the salary factor that multiplies out.
Thank you. Thank you. And we'll certainly get to the answer to that question. I'd really like to move along now and try to get our agenda completed a little quicker. Representative Widener, you have a quick question to the point.
Kind of a procedural question. We don't need a fiscal impact or anything on this to send it to Ways and Means, do we? We can just send it to Ways and Means?
I think so.
We're supposed to have fiscal impacts, but when it goes to Ways and Means, we can get a fiscal light generally. But so it's not a full-blown fiscal impact. That's another step in the process. We don't need those numbers right now. I'm sure we will get them. So thank you very much for your testimony today. Up next, I'd like to have Anna Keenan Mudrick.
That was really close. Anna Keenan Mudrick.
Oh, geez.
So close.
I almost said Murdoch. I have a hard time remembering names these days for some reason. Welcome. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, dear Chair Holvey and members of the committee, my name is Anna Keenan Mudrick. I am the co-chair of the Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities Coalition. I am also the executive. Can you hear me? Okay.
Oh, fine.
I'm also the executive director of Community Access Services, which is a provider organization that provides residential and vocational services and supports to adults who experience developmental disabilities. So I'm here primarily representing the IDD Coalition, but also wearing the provider organization hat that I have. The IDD Coalition is neutral on House Bill 2618, but we do have some concerns that we'd like to express and put on the record today. House Bill 2618 provides employees of the Department of Human Services whose duties include maintaining safety, behavior, and control of residents of certain residential facilities qualify as police officers under the public employees retirement system, as you just were hearing much detail about. As you may know, workers in these residential facilities are providing care, they're providing training to some of our most vulnerable citizens who experience developmental disabilities. We absolutely recognize that this is hard work. We know it well ourselves as well. Many of us, like my provider organization with the provider hat, Community Access Services, we've transitioned several individuals who previously were supported in the SACU homes into our group homes and in more community-based settings, and we understand absolutely that there are many challenges there. And for others who never did live in SACU, but many of whom lived in Fairview, present a lot of support challenges, and absolutely get that. So not at all wanting to sound insensitive, and want to make that clear, and again coming in a neutral stance, but wanting to stay concerned about this categorization and the way that that categorizes employees in a way that is more about correction, more of a correctional feel to it, calling staff or referring to them as in a category of police officers versus support workers, caregivers, has a very different feel to it. So that is, you know, and when you look at what the definition of a police officer is, it's for individuals who have committed crimes. There's that legal mandate and leverage that then police officers have. This is, again, a very tough setting to work in. It can be very challenging, but it is not a jail. So it concerns me when we kind of talk about categorizing employees who are providing the support. The really primary focus is about care, about skills training, and again, to our very vulnerable citizens, many of whom have had quite a history in our state and in the nation, not just an Oregon issue, of course. So wanting to be sensitive to how that looks, also how we are talking about the people who we support who are in these facilities. And again, police officers, it is a different job than being a police officer. sorry. I'm a little nervous. This is my, I'm a talker, but this is my first time testifying in this type of setting, so I apologize for that. You can see I'm nervous. I'm sorry. You've got my written testimony as well, but just to skip to point three here, qualifying workers in residential facilities as police officers puts us on a slippery slope where the presumed authority of these employees might infringe on the fundamental rights of individuals residing in these homes. We have to be very careful about that. Also, what's Medicaid right now, of course, provides our funding, as you guys know, and more over the last, you know, particularly 20 years, certainly we've gotten more evolved in the types of supports and services we provide, much more positive behavioral approach versus a more punitive, fear-based approach. It's been proven to be more effective, and we've really evolved in a lot of ways as a system. I'm not saying we're perfect, that's for sure, but we've made a lot of progress, and there are some really positive results in transitioning individuals from much more structured, fear-based settings into more positive community-based settings where then a lot of the assault types of things that you're hearing about still may occur, but with a much less frequently. And again, the way that we're providing supports, even when we are in situations where we get hurt, we don't think of ourselves as police officers or as guards. So it concerns me to hear it talked about in that manner. And then the way Medicaid funds us, the spirit of Medicaid is to talk about how do we help provide more integration? How do we respect? How do we honor rights? And when we're talking about policing people and guarding people, I fear then that we're also going to begin infringing upon people's rights more. And I'm not saying that that is what this bill does in and of itself. I feel like there is good intention behind the bill, which is, again, why we're saying neutral, that it's about trying to get some better benefits for very hardworking employees. We don't take issue with that. It's more about the categorization, not wanting to give the impression that now we're considering people who are providing this intensive level support as police officers or as guards. That's really the concern. So what we're saying here today is we'd like to continue to the discussion. Is there another way that we can still reach this outcome for this group of employees that doesn't categorize them as police officers? That would be very important just for the people we support who, again, have been through quite a lot. We support people who lived in Fairview, many of whom have who recall seeing police officers on Fairview and don't think of that fondly. Many of whom were subject to types of support that were more punitive. So being sensitive to that, thinking of how can we, again, support this category of employees in a way that really does make sense, that really helps support them, that doesn't, though, categorize them as police officers or as guards. So, again, we welcome conversations about how to achieve the purpose of the bill without reclassifying support workers as police officers.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Chair Holby. Just a question as to how this works. I mean, we heard from the last testimony the working conditions, the low pay, obviously not a maybe high turnover, I don't know. But I'm wondering how this works if someone goes in and starts the job but then quits in 5 years. And obviously I would think you would have a lot of turnover. Do they retain that level of retirement at after 25, or if they go into another job, do they then bounce over to that, whatever that retirement age is?
I'm sorry, I don't know, because I am the executive director of a nonprofit, the private, so we don't have PERS, so I can't answer that. I would be probably
and perhaps we can get your question answered after the committee.
I'm sorry, I have to follow that. Sorry.
I'm sure somebody's here that can answer
Chair
that
Holby
question.
And Representative Barreto. I apologize for not knowing.
That's fine.
So I do appreciate your testimony, and I can understand your concerns, but I think this bill is really not about changing the classification of these employees. It's just that this classification for purposes of the PERS system will treat them the same as police officers, and I'm not hearing that they're going to, you know, put badges on that say police officer when they walk into work, or even change the way they deliver their services. But we can have that conversation, I think. But it, I don't, and I could appreciate your concerns about the perception of that. But I think this perception is clearly a just in relationship to the PERS system and the benefits these workers receive. So I, and I will clarify that later, that we're not going to change their classification to be police officers. So when they walk into work, that they're, you know, now officer Ralph Groner or whatever the case may be. So thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it.
Thank you,
Officer Groner sounds scary to me.
With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2618. Committee, I'm going to go ahead and skip to a work session. So with that, I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2415.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure was before you on February 11th. This is the, we'd be looking at the proposed Dash 2 amendments because they replace the original measure. The Dash 2 amendment allows DHS and OHA to request the financial institutions to release specified information regarding the deposit accounts held by deceased persons. And it creates exceptions to the prohibited release of private financial records. On the Dash 2 amendment, there's no revenue impact. There is a fiscal statement issued.
And what, pray tell, does that fiscal statement say?
It is on OLIS for everyone to see. Boils down to the fiscal impact. This is the language used by LFO. The fiscal impact of this bill on DHS and OHA is determinant, and it goes on to explain why, but it is an indeterminate fiscal amount.
Okay, so with that, we'd be looking for a motion to adopt the Dash 2 amendment.
Where do you see it? Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2415.
Representative Barton moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2415. Okay. Discussion? Not seeing any. Is there any objection to adopting the Dash 2 amendment? Seeing none, the Dash 2 amendment is adopted into House Bill 2415.
Can I move to the floor, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Chair Holby, I move House Bill 2415 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2415 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. I do want to thank the financial industry for stepping up and helping get this bill crafted correctly so that it's going to be work much better. So having said that, Matthew, can you call the roll, please?
Representative Barreto.
Yes.
Representative Doherty.
Yes.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Evans.
Yes.
Representative Fagan.
Yes.
Representative Hurd.
Aye.
Representative Nuss.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenneberg.
Excused.
Chair Holden.
Aye. House Bill 2415, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would somebody like to carry this bill?
I will.
Thank you, Representative Doherty. Representative Doherty will be the carrier. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2415. And I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2439.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure was heard February 11th. It is the measure that requires the party requesting a hearing to be reopened with the Office of Administrative Hearings to provide a copy of that request to the Employment Department. It allows the Employment Department to dismiss a request for a hearing with the OAH under specified circumstances, declares an emergency. And there is the proposed Dash 1 amendment that specifies that if the department dismisses a hearing request, the party may request a hearing on that dismissal. On the Dash 1 amendment, there's no revenue impact and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
So with that, could I have a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendment, please?
Mr. Chair, I move that Dash 1 amendments be incorporated into House Bill 2439.
Representative Barton moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2439. Is there discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the Dash 1 amendment? Seeing none, the Dash 1 amendment is adopted into House Bill 2439. And committee, I'm not going to move this bill quite yet today. So with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2439. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2807. So, Jan, are you ready to give us a description of House Bill 2807?
This is going to sound very familiar because it's very similar to the bill we just heard. This bill classifies as a police officer under PERS any full-time community college faculty member who's employed to teach within a secure perimeter of a correctional institution. It declares an emergency effective on a passage, and there are no amendments.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And to testify today, we have Alan McLean, and it's not Nancy, but Mary Botkin.
Oh, and then that's a repeat. That's it.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of you know me as Nancy Botkin, but... for the record, Mary Botkin, I'm here this morning representing AFSCME Council 75 and the community college instructors who work inside the prison system providing adult basic education for inmates. I'm going to be very brief. You've got my written testimony. I don't want to, you know, I'm not going to read that. But just by way of background, I want everybody to sort of understand the history of our educators in the prison system. Up until the mid-90s, educators were part of the bargaining unit for AFSCME. They were considered dual trained. They were not only educators, but they were also security staff and correctional officers. So they were trained in both areas. In the 90s, the Community College Association, under the leadership of Dana Anderson, was successful in convincing legislators that the community colleges under contract could provide educational services to inmates much better than a, quote, correctional officer could. We were unsuccessful in stopping that effort, and the community colleges took over all educational programs under contract with the Department of Corrections. When they took over those contracts, those individuals providing the educational services inside the prison system lost their police and fire status under PERS. And because it became employees of community colleges, they were no longer covered under an AFSCME agreement either. That has changed over the last couple of years, and Alan will talk about that. We now represent correctional educators who work at the Treasure Valley Community College and introduce this bill because those individuals work exclusively for the prison system. They do not provide educational services in any other environment. They are full-time permanent educational staff working for TVCC under a contract with the Department of Corrections, and they work directly with inmates. And that's all they do. This bill, I worked with Legislative Council. We tried to craft the definition very tightly so that a community college instructor that might have some passive contact with someone who's been sentenced to the Department of Corrections and is in a community program or on an early release program, they would not qualify for this. This has to be somebody who is actually working inside the secure perimeter of the institution and exclusively working as a adult educator for inmates in that environment. With that, I'm here mostly now to answer questions after Alan testifies. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, and he's never done this before, so.
We'll go easy.
Name first.
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair, members of the committee, I'm Alan McLean, and I work for Oregon AFSCME as council representative. Prior to that, I was a correctional officer at Snake River Correctional Institution for almost 11 years. So when I began my new employment with Oregon AFSCME, I became a representative for the teachers from TVCC who I used to work with and provide security for those teachers. And they asked me, why don't they have police and fire PERS? And I always thought they did. I assumed everyone who worked in the institution had police and fire PERS. So I didn't know the answer, and I went to my coworkers, and we thought they did have police and fire PERS, but they don't. So that was approximately 3 years ago when I started my job, and we've been working on it since, and I had no good answer for them. So these teachers, they work a variety. They do a variety of different, teach all kinds of inmates, basic education. They teach special needs, English as a second language, some with mental disabilities, with the goal of getting the inmates in a rehabilitated enough so that they can be productive in society when they release. So in the classroom, they have approximately 20 to 30 inmates, students in the classroom. Some of those may be their tutors, but for the most part, they are in the classroom to learn. So a lot of these inmates are in for all different sorts of crimes, for murder, sex offenses. Some are security threat group members. They're violent people. They can be. These teachers work there by themselves. They have no radio. They have no telephone in their classrooms. They do have an officer that comes around once in a while. That officer has several other duties he has to do at the same time, including he oversees the inmate barbershop, which has a lot of tools in there that are very dangerous. And he also oversees the inmate medication line where they hand out Schedule I drugs and so forth. So he has to be present there too. So during the course of the classes, he gets around there once in a while. But if something happens in those classrooms, the classrooms are buried back in an area where most people don't go around. So it is a very dangerous environment they work in. They're subject to all the same dangers as correctional officers, as we have many other people who are covered under police and fire that work in the institution, including building maintenance, clerical people. We have counselors. Virtually everyone in that institution is covered by police and fire except these instructors. I have eight of them that work there. And I include an example. I give you my written testimony also. I include an example of one employee who worked for TVCC. And at the time, there were no inmates in the education area. She was back in her office in the education area. And an inmate walked in, inmate Abel Quino Sanchez. He walked in and attacked her. There was nobody else in the area. This time, there were no inmates in the area. This inmate was not even an education student. He came in from a different part of the institution. He went in there specifically to rape her. He was in conviction. He was already convicted of rape. That's why he was in prison. He knew where the secluded area is, and he went back there where this TVCC employee was. He had a string to tie her up. His intent was to rape her. So he eventually was charged and convicted of attempted rape, and he had an extended sentence. The employee eventually left employment. She didn't work there too much longer. It really scared her. She's now retired. The inmate was eventually deported to Mexico. So these teachers are subject, virtually everything a correctional officer is subject to, and so I would strongly urge that we allow them police and fire PERS protections. I thank you, and I'll answer any questions if you have any, or Mary, maybe I'll answer some.
Representative Evans.
Yes, sir. I just more of a technical question than anything else, and I want to make sure I understand. in these cases where the community college is contracting a service, is there a baseline minimum for how long that contract needs to be in place or how long the employee would need to be working in those conditions to be basically on that track for the police versus not? Because my concern is what happens if we change contracts or something else. I don't want someone put in that situation. Right.
They have to be full-time educators under contract with the Department of Corrections. So they can't be part-time. They can't be here today and not, you know, they can't be a casual instructor.
For how long?
Could I add to that?
Yeah.
Sure.
Chair Hovey and Representative Evans, they are already covered under PERS, most of them. And we have some that have been there 16, 17 years. Some have been there. The newest one's only been there like 6 months. But they're not vested in PERS till after 5 years, just like everybody else. So they have to be vested after 5 years and then continue working. Does that answer the question?
Follow up. So at the community college, I work at Chemeketa, and it would be, if Chemeketa were to do this, for example, if there was an expansion, so this is hypothetical, but so I understand it, somebody could work at the community college for a number of years, Chemeketa gets the contract, they go and work inside the secure facility, and after a couple of years, they decide they want to go teach at another facility that's not in the same environment. Mm-hmm. Were they, or Chemeketa drops the contract because of funding. I want to make sure that there's clarity for the person involved that's already a PERS employee, but which track of PERS do they go and how is that established? That's my question.
They would not continue to get police and fire if they were no longer under contract at the corrections. I mean, you have to stay, you know, if you're a corrections officer and you leave corrections employment and go to work for the Department of Transportation as a work crew supervisor, you don't get police and fire anymore.
I just wanted to make sure that was clear. Yeah. Thank you.
You have to stay in the position to get it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. If you'd like to ask questions, we can carry this bill over. If you think you can't get your questions answered, we have to adjourn at 9:15, and I got a little bit more business to do.
No problem. Technical stuff.
I'm sure Mary can come back. I don't know that we would require you to come back if you probably have other things to do. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2807 and open up a work session for the purpose of introducing committee bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move the following four legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 741, dated February 6, 2015. LC 2777, dated January 23rd, LC 2869, dated January 23rd, 2015, and LC 2973, dated January 27th, 2015. Move they be introduced as committee bills.
Thank you. Representative Barton moves LC 741, dated February 6, 2015, LC 2777, dated January 27th, 2015, LC 2869, dated January 23rd, 2015, and LC 2973, dated January 27th, 2015, be introduced as committee bills. This is purely a procedural motion to bring these bills to the legislature for possible consideration. Doesn't mean you support or oppose the bill. Just allows them to be introduced. So with that, is there any other discussion on these bills? Seeing none, is there any objection to introducing them as committee bills? Seeing none, the bills are introduced as committee bills, or the legislative concepts are introduced as committee bills. And I close the work session on introducing committee bills and adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. You can leave now.